You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Barter House. The Barter House is a proud supporter of the Heritage Radio Network. The Barter House works with family vineyards and small bottlers from around the world to bring only the finest and most flavorful wines to market. To learn more about the Barter House, please visit them on the web at thebarterhouse.com or call them at 917-463-3076. Welcome to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Erica Weitz, your host. And this is episode 57 of Why We Cook. Wow, we've come a long way. So I like to read the Atlantic Monthly's online food page. I think it's called the Atlantic Food Page. It's a daily that the Atlantic does online. And I was reading it yesterday, and it's like one of the only food blogs that I kind of cover really regularly. I make sure to read it. And on it yesterday was a follow-up to a big story that I had been following for a while. And it's not a new story. It's been around for a couple of years now. But I've been following it because I find it, you know, very interesting. And it's a story about corruption and deception and fraud. And it involves China. The people involved have been indicted. That's why there was this follow-up story. And they're not just Chinese, but a couple of Germans too, which isn't surprising, considering that coming out of China in the past few years, we've had the melamine scandal, we've had the tainted milk scandal, we've had the soy sauce made out of hair scandal, and all the other scandals that seem to come out of China these days that have to do with tainted food, paid off officials, corrupt factory owners. I'm sure it's not just China, it's the world, but it seems to all come out of China lately. The lack of federal inspection on our side doesn't help, etc., etc. But anyway, this time around, this scandal caught my eye because this scandal is all about honey. It's a massive fraud and corruption case that involves antibiotic and fungicide tainted honey from China. Now, China has a lot of honeybees. China's the world's biggest producer of honey. And in the 90s, they had a big problem with honeybee disease. And so they treated their honeybee hives with antibiotics and with chloramphenicol and other fungicides, which are drugs that are banned for use in beekeeping here in the U.S. and in Europe and in other parts of the world, but the Chinese still use it. So because some of their honey is tainted with these drugs, they can't export it to the U.S. It's illegal. And even what they do try to export to the U.S. often isn't even really honey. There's a lot of fraud going on in China, and what they ship is not always honey. It's actually flavored corn syrup, colored flavored corn syrup, or sugar syrup in barrels labeled honey. And because of that, because of all this faux honey, they're actually able to sell it so much cheaper on the world market than the current price for honey that if they try to sell it here, the non-tainted stuff, they have to pay what are called dumping duties because the price is so much lower. So they have to pay a high tax on it. And they don't want to pay the dumping duty. So instead, this so-called honey or this tainted stuff gets shipped from China to other countries, to intermediary countries, where it gets repackaged in labels that are falsely painted barrels that give the country of origin as that other country. They get new fake paperwork, the barrels, and then the honey gets shipped from those countries into the U.S., where it's then repacked by U.S. honey packers and sold to you, the unsuspecting consumer. Some of the honey comes from countries that don't even produce honey, that have no beekeeping industry. And some of that honey is varietals that come from flowers that don't grow in those countries. Like buckwheat, which only grows in cooler northern climates, doesn't come from places like Indonesia. So when I first read this story, it was online. It was in the Seattle PI, the Post Intelligencer. They broke the story, and the guy who covered it in great depth. It's actually a whole series of articles, and you should really check it out because it's quite horrifying. The the journalist who covered it went into so much more depth, and I don't want to take the time here to really go into depth, but basically that's what it comes down to. Fraud, corruption, deception, tainted product, lack of inspection here, blah, 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 the usual. But, you know, yet again, in the wake of this, you know, egg scandal that we've had here, unsafe eggs, it just underscores how unsafe our food system really is and how casual we are in accepting food products that come not just from abroad, but domestically too, and trusting in them. And we just trust that this food that is being sold to us in our local Mega Mart is safe. And it's not always safe. And something like honey, which has always had this health halo around it, you know, people think that simply if something says it has honey in it, it's got these sort of magical healing, curing properties to it. And that's definitely not the case, especially because many products that say they contain honey don't even actually contain honey. They contain like honey flavor in them. Just because something has honey in it doesn't mean it's good. And a lot of the honey out there on the market isn't good. So you got to be really careful about your honey. And I eat a lot of honey and I love it and I have bees and I'm hoping they'll produce some for me this year. But if you're concerned about the quality and the purity of the honey that you eat, you should really only buy it from someone you trust. Your local beekeeper, apiarist. You know, if you have a farmer's market near you, chances are there's somebody locally who raises bees and has honey. And ask them about their bees. Ask them what they do for diseases. How do they treat them? Do they use fungicides? You know, what do they do? Ask them if they pool their honey with other suppliers or sell it to a packer. You know, the closer you get to the source with most food, the better off you are, as we have seen in this egg salmonella scandal that's happened to us, or, you know, the gigantic spinach E. coli outbreak of a couple years ago. You can't trust suppliers, repackers, middlemen, or the government to do the right thing with your food. You have to kind of go to the source and ask questions about our food. We're so blindly trusting of industry and of business. It's kind of scary. And the honey industry, like most other industries, is self-regulating. They don't actually have to follow the rules because no one's breathing down their neck saying you have to follow the rules. We're just hoping that they follow the rules. And there are almost no rules, actually, that apply. And most of what's on those labels is made up. Like, there's no organic certification for honey, but honey producers say that they're organic. Anyway, so read this guy's thing in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. You'll see what I'm talking about. But I like to buy my honey from Andrew Cote, who owns Silvermine Apiaries. And I've mentioned him before on here because he's the guy that I learned beekeeping from. I took a class with him in the New York City Beekeepers Association. So I like to, you know, kind of go full circle. And he taught me. And so I like to buy my honey from him, and particularly his buckwheat honey. I really like that. And if you're in New York, he's at the Union Square Market on Wednesdays, and I would like to give him a little shout out. My bees are right here, not 50 feet away from where I'm sitting, on the roof overlooking the garden that's in the back here at Roberta's, where we broadcast from, and they seem to be doing very well. They've certainly made a ton of honey this year for themselves, but they haven't really made much for me yet, and that seems to be the case in your first year of beekeeping, that the bees don't really produce all that much for you and you're supposed to leave it for them. And that's okay. I'm not going to take, you know, what's not mine. Although really, I mean, it is mine. I gave them the home. I fed them in spring. I gave them a place to live, but I understand. Although when I asked Andrew about it a couple days ago, he actually said I could steal some of their honey and they'd be okay, which totally contradicts everything he taught us in the class, which said you can't steal their honey, that they'll die. So I don't know who to believe these days. It's sort of like, you know, mom says one thing, dad says the other thing. But in this case, mom and dad are the same person. I'm not sure if I want to rob my own bees of their honey. We'll see in a couple weeks. We're going to be harvesting honey here in a couple weeks. So we'll see what happens. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, more about honey. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by The Barter House. To learn more about The Barter House, visit them online at thebarterhouse.com or call them at 917-463-3076. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Weitz, your host. And hopefully you're listening to this live tonight, but if not, you can always listen to us on iTunes. You can podcast any of our shows. You can also listen to any of our shows archived on heritageradionetwork.com. And you can leave comments on there too. And we love the comments. I really want to know what you think and what these shows mean to you and what you have to say. You know, positive or negative, I can take it. Let me know. Also, if you're a fan of Why We Cook, you can join us on the Why We Cook Facebook page. Just search for Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network and drop me a line. Let me know you're listening. Anyway, so I was talking about this honey scandal in the first segment and about China and their corruption and fraud when it comes to their honey. And that this week, the follow-up to it that I had read online was that some of the guilty parties have now been indicted. There's been some actual arresting going on and people are being held accountable. So that's good. It's about time. But I thought it was really kind of a fitting, I don't know, irony, coincidence, timing, that this all kind of is coming to a head, coming full circle this week, because this week is the beginning of all the Jewish holidays, and it's Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year. And the Jewish New Year, you know, is very symbolic of sort of an ending and a beginning, the circle of the year, the cyclical nature of the year is coming to a close and then beginning again. And it's also, we're coming up on Yom Kippur, where you atone for your sins. So I think in this Chinese honey industry, there's a lot of atoning to be done in the next few weeks. But what I thought was interesting was that on Rosh Hashanah, one of the most traditional things you do is eat honey. Honey is this great symbol of Rosh Hashanah, and you eat honey and you eat this honey cake that's traditional, and you're supposed to take apples and challah and dip them into honey. And so I thought, wow, what timing. It couldn't have worked out better that this whole big scandalous story breaks now, right on the, you know, practically on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, which is tomorrow. Now, I am not a religious person at all. Like, there is not one drop of religiosity in me. I am a non-believer. But culturally, there are certain traditions about Judaism that I like. And of course, I like food traditions because, you know, that's who I am. And many of the best food traditions stem from religion and from religious ritual. And so I like to have a Seder at Passover, mostly because I like the food and because I like to make my own matzah, not because I observe any sort of, you know, religious part of it. But I also really like fall. I like this time of year, and I like fall foods. I like autumn vegetables a lot. And Rosh Hashanah is like the perfect fall festival because it's supposed to be the beginning of the year. In the Hebrew calendar, this is the beginning of the year. And in my mind, September is and always will be the beginning of the new year. Even though I haven't been in school for like 20 years, September to me, it's a new year. And so I've always loved this kind of fall, Rosh Hashanah, harvesty feel. You know, there's Sukkot too, which is like actually the harvest festival coming up. And I've always loved honey, and I've always loved that honey cake. It's like this loaf-shaped cake made obviously with a lot of honey, but also with a lot of spices, a lot of dark spices, you know, cloves and cinnamon and black pepper and, you know, the deep dark spices. And you put some really strong coffee in there too, and that adds this like depth and bitterness and this, you know, edge to it that I like. It's sort of like gingerbread. It's a lot like gingerbread actually, but the honey gives it this kind of deep caramelized flavor, and the spices are less Christmassy and more, I don't know, Jewishy, more Jewishy spices, more redolent in a way of the Middle East, I would say, than of like, I don't know, Christmas in Germany. We try to stay away from that idea. And it's this cake that I grew up eating, and I used to eat it with really milky tea at my Russian grandmother's house when she was alive and lived in deepest, darkest Brooklyn, as I like to call it. We would go to her house, and she would cut up slices of this cake and serve me tea. And And it was great. And she just bought it locally. But you can make honey cake. It's actually pretty easy. It's an easy cake to make. And there's some great recipes out there. I was looking on Epicurious, and the first couple of them looked really good. But what you want to do is, if you make it, don't skimp on the quality of the honey. You want to use good honey, like something really dark, like a buckwheat or a heather. And don't buy the cheap stuff. Like, you know, buy the good honey. I don't understand. People will pay like $40 for a bottle of a product that they'll put on their face. But when it comes to food, we want the cheapest food possible. It's all mixed up. It's all like totally inverted there. You know, you freak out if a dozen eggs at a green market is $4 or $5, yet you'll drop $25-$30 in the store for like a piece of meat. What's that about? You get six meals out of the eggs. Anyway, so buy the good stuff if you're going to make this cake. Buy dark honey. You know, really go for it. Splurge. It's a new year. And remember that a lot of the cheaper bulk market honey that's sold out there is probably adulterated with corn syrup or sugar syrup and may not even be real honey. So like where I teach in a culinary school, and we get in, you know, honey by the gallons and we use it. And when you taste it, it has absolutely nothing to it. It's flat. There's no complexity. I don't think it's even real. You know, your sort of mainstream bulk honey. I don't think it's the real deal. And anyway, so honey has always been this sort of very symbolic, you know, Israel, land of milk and honey and all that. And Jews and honey, there's always been this kind of connection. But here's a great little bit of trivia for your next quiz night or your next cocktail party. Get this. Honey is the only kosher food that comes from a non-kosher animal. Isn't that crazy? The reason for this is that bees are concentrating nectar into honey, you know, for their hive. So the honey's not a product of the bee's body, and it's not an animal product. It's sort of a incidental product. Like, they're making it for their hive. They're not making it. I can't even explain it. But anyway, it's the only kosher food that comes from a non-kosher animal. Bees aren't kosher because they're scavengers, even though they scavenge for pollen and nectar. Not that you'd eat bees anyway, but, and not that I keep kosher. But anyway, it's also, since it's not an animal product, it's also parv, which means it's not meat or dairy, so you could eat it in either meal. But if you have vegan friends, which, you know, I'm sorry if you do have vegan friends, but they won't eat honey because they consider it an animal product. They say it exploits the bees. Now, if you were to take a look inside my beehive back here at the upper deep, which is where the bees store honey for themselves, I will tell you that those bees are making so much honey for themselves in there, they could use a little exploitation because they are becoming honey bound, as Andrew called it. And I say exploit away. They need to be liberated. Anyway, Rosh Hashanah also, of course, coincides with the start of the autumn apple season, and it's traditional to dip apples in honey as this way to celebrate the new year. And that use of apples and honey actually comes from the Ashkenazi tradition. It's a late medieval Ashkenazi tradition, although now it's been sort of almost universally accepted by all Jews. It's become very symbolic. And round foods in general are symbolic of rebirth and renewal. You know, at Passover, you eat the hard-boiled egg. Like at Easter, you eat the egg. It's round, it's renewal, it's rebirth. So you eat the eggs in the spring and you eat apples in the fall. Symbolic. And we're just like sticking a toe into apple season right now here. They're barely apples in the market yet. And I won't even buy any apples yet until I have eaten the very last peach that I can find and consume. But I am heading out to Oregon this week. I'm going out to Portland to visit my BFF, Lisa. And Oregon is, you know, fruit country. I mean, they grow some of the best fruit in the country. And they're a lot further north than us. So it's probably already apple season up there in Oregon. So I think we'll buy some local apples and we'll buy some local honey while I'm out there. And we'll have ourselves a little dip fest. I thought we would celebrate Rosh Hashanah by sitting on her couch and watching all the seasons of Arrested Development back to back while we eat honey cake and dip some apples in honey, which sounds like my idea of a perfect New Year's celebration. I think that's actually kind of what we did on the real New Year's in January this past year. We have to take another quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by The Barter House. Barter House is a proud supporter of the Heritage Radio Network. Visit them on the web at thebarterhouse.com. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides. And we've been talking tonight about honey and Rosh Hashanah and apples and the impending fall. And at work, I teach at a culinary school. I have a colleague, Mike Schwartz, who has actually been on the show before talking about kombucha because he owns a company called Bao, Badass Organics, and they make kombucha. And he was on a couple months ago to talk about kombucha. But Mike and I like to giggle every year over the same joke. You know, you have a friend who you can make the same joke with, and every year you laugh about it. Well, every year we make the same joke that everyone cuts out of work early this week because they have to go home for Rosh Hashanah, which is what we call Rosh Hashanah. And, you know, we're like six-year-olds. Like, we still think it's hysterical. We say Rosh Hashanah a couple times, and we crack ourselves up. Because, you know, everybody uses it as an excuse to go home early the night before. You know, suddenly we all become these, like, super observant Jews, and we have to beat the sun getting down to make sure we're home before sunset. You know, we all need our rituals, after all. So, you know, like I was saying in the earlier segment, Rosh Hashanah meals usually include apples and honey to symbolize a sweet new year. And, of course, something round like a challah, like a round bread, and that symbolizes the cycle of the year, the round cycle of the year. But other foods with symbolic meanings have been served in different cultures, too. And this was kind of interesting, sort of depending on your local custom. It's very typical on Rosh Hashanah to serve tongue or other meat from the head of an animal or to serve a fish head because it symbolizes the head or the beginning of the year. Because Rosh Hashanah actually literally means the head of the year. Excuse me. So you could serve, you know, pork cheeks. No, maybe that would be a little bit offensive, but I would. And we were talking about China and Chinese honey in the first segment. And that reminded me that pomegranates are used in many Rosh Hashanah traditions too, because they come into season now in the fall. And I remember the first time I ate a pomegranate, it was at my other grandparents, the ones who were Orthodox, probably over the holidays in the fall sometimes, and they always called them Chinese apples. Now, why was it way back when, in the 70s, the pre-enlightened food era, that anything that was foreign was Chinese? Does anybody remember this? Like Napa cabbage was called Chinese cabbage. Cilantro, Chinese parsley. Pomegranates, Chinese apples. Was China just this sort of catch-all place for all things that were non-European in origin? Is that what it was? Pomegranates don't even come from China. They come from the Arab world. They made their way into Europe through Granada when the Arabs invaded Spain and built the Alhambra, and they planted pomegranate trees there. Not China. They don't come from there. Even the name pomegranate means apple of Granada, pomme de Grenade, apple of Granada, not pomme de Chine. They're not from China. Anyway, I don't know. But my family are Ashkenazi, or so I've always been told, which is more of like the Eastern European kind of Jews. But if you know me or if you've ever seen a picture of me, I look more like Italian or Spanish or something than some, you know, pasty-faced Russian or Romanian. So I think that there's some Sephardic stuff going on in my genes, not so much Ashkenazi. And even if there isn't, the food is so much better in that crowd of Jews that I'm just going to pretend to be one. So Sephardic Jews, of course, when they celebrate the holidays, do the apples dipped in honey. But they'll also bake them or cook them down into sort of like a compote called manzanada. But they also eat all those great Sephardic-y things like dates and pomegranates, and black-eyed peas are very symbolic of the new year for them, which is very interesting because in the American South, in the African tradition, on New Year's, in January New Year's, you eat black-eyed peas also. And the Sephardic Jews eat black-eyed peas. There's a connection there. Anyway, they also make these pastries, these like savory pumpkin-filled pastries, and leek fritters and beets that get baked and peeled and served whole because they look like heads. And of course, fish with a whole head intact. Doesn't that sound better to you than some, like, you know, boiled potato, boiled meat kind of thing? Like my family used to eat. It's also common to symbolize the year by eating foods that are stuffed, because then it sort of, you know, it symbolizes like a year stuffed full of blessings or good wishes. So I like that idea. So stuffed vegetables, nice, right? So much better, don't you think? I think I want to be Sephardic. Where do I sign up? I want to trade. And anyway, of course, this time of year, for my people's tradition, this is when the gefilte fish gets pulled out. And most people think gefilte fish is truly disgusting, unless you grew up eating it and love it like I do, and we love it in my house. And this is when it shows up at Costco, which I love, because I'm all about the deal. And my husband and I love gefilte fish. And at Costco, around the holidays, around now and around Passover, you can get this gigantic jar of it. And it's like three times the size of the supermarket jar, and it's the same price. So it's $8 for a jar of 16 pieces instead of $8 for a jar with like 5 pieces in it. And, you know, I love a bargain. He loves gefilte fish. So twice a year, we make a pilgrimage, holy pilgrimage, Aliyah, if you know anybody in Israel, to Costco, and we stock up once at Passover and once at Rosh Hashanah. And it completes our year. It's sort of the two points of the year. One marks this early beginning of spring. One marks the beginning of the new year. And Passover is also right around the time when you get your bees ready for spring. You wake them up. You inspect their hive. You get ready for a season of beekeeping. And Rosh Hashanah is around the time when you harvest your honey. See, it's the great round cycle of the year. We're at a time, unfortunately, but Happy New Year to all you Hebes out there, and we'll see you next week. Good night.